In this special episode of Guidewire, the Fast Tracks team and I have a conversation with a group of hospital medicine experts from UNC Healthcare about anticipated needs with respect to the COVID-19 outbreak. Please note that the audio quality in this particular recording is a little different because we've been practicing social isolation and we were calling in on a video conference line. This was also set up very impromptu, and as you all know, this situation is rapidly evolving. We hope that you guys are staying safe out there, and I hope that you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation. We are the boots on the ground inside of healthcare working to uncover and solve high-impact, unmet medical needs.
I'll start by introducing myself. I'm Devin Hubbard, as I mentioned earlier. I'm the lead design engineer for Fast Tracks, and I'm also the host of the Guidewire podcast. My role in Fast Tracks is primarily as a design engineer and to help out with knickknacks around the design world and manufacturing. And so let me pass the torch to Nabil, who also works with me.
Hi, my name is Nabil. I'm also an engineer at Fast Tracks. My background is in software systems and electrical engineering. I've been with the group for a year. I'm excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, and then if we want to hop over to Rob, and then we'll cycle through everybody. So Rob, can you tell us a little bit about you?
Yeah, so I think I'm the one person who knows probably everybody on the call right now, but one of the hospitals here at UNC. I also work as a physician advisor, so I do a lot of stuff with patient flow, and work together on a few different projects for new devices, and we'll see how those things come to fruition.
Great. And then Nick?
Yep. Hey, I think you guys all know me, Nick Piazza. I've been working for the last couple months with Rob on a couple of these projects, so it's been a lot of fun.
Fantastic. And then Christine and Rhea. Christine?
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm one of the MedPeds hospitalists working on both sides COVID teams. I have spent some time in the hospital in the last week doing some rule out admissions. Luckily, all those folks have ruled out. I also work with Rob as a physician advisor for case management and utilization management.
Fantastic. And Rhea?
Hey, I'm Rhea Dansel, also another MedPeds hospitalist and the lead for our medicine procedure service, which is all ultrasound guided and also point of care ultrasound.
Well, thank you all for introducing yourselves really quickly. And to let you all know, what I'd like to do now is I'd like to ask the question to each of you. The purpose of today's conversation is really to probe a little deeper. At this point, what we've been told and Fast Tracks from the administration and from other folks is that the two primary concerns that I think we've uncovered are PPE related, and another is sort of ventilation related with regards to keeping patients on vents, et cetera, and access to those pieces of equipment and shortages anticipated. Where we wanted to head for today's conversation was maybe a little bit more, possibly longer term, but maybe more specific to hospital medicine. So the question that I'm going to ask here is, to get the discussion going, is for each of you to think about what problem or problems do you think may not be obvious to everyone else that maybe are on your minds, specifically with regard to COVID and your practice. And so I wonder, Rob, if you don't mind talking about some of the concerns or potentially anticipated pitfalls that you could see inside of hospital medicine unfolding with regards to COVID.
I think the number one thing is just the basically how easy it is to spread this infection. And, you know, we've seen that around the world with the sheer numbers, and then also with the hospital staff that have become infected in various places, where like Italy is going to their medical students. So I think from my perspective, that's a really big issue. How do you prevent infection? You know, and PPE is the currently how we do that. Are there, I guess one question for me is just how do we just keep the infection from happening?
Do you anticipate anything on the hospital medicine? Like, I know you spend a lot of time in the OBS unit at UNC. Are there things in the OBS unit that maybe people aren't thinking about yet, or that may not be, you know, common knowledge?
I think we hopefully don't get to the point that we're having to put these patients in an observation unit. The part of the thing is, you know, for our physical plant, you know, we have several rooms that you just can't make into negative pressure. There's no easy engineering solution for that because the buildings were built so long ago. And so I would say in the observation unit, if we got so deep into this that we were having to utilize those rooms, how do you retrofit an existing hospital room to actually be able to care for these patients?
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Yeah, like what do you do when you run out of physical space to safely house individuals that for containment reasons? Nick, thoughts?
Yeah, are we kind of specifically thinking about prevention at this point or just kind of general thoughts right now?
Anything that you can think of that maybe we haven't considered yet?
Yeah. So I guess the one thought that I kept coming back to when I was looking over the mural here was, you know, we're seeing a really variable kind of phenotype with people, you know, presenting in different ways with this, you know, some more severe, some less severe, you know, and a lot of the patients we're hearing reports of, you know, like, you know, some patients are progressing to, you know, some bad cardiac, you know, complications associated with this. So my thoughts for kind of innovations have been, what ways can we identify people who are kind of at, in that higher risk phenotype? So I guess kind of ways of early stratification of those patients.
Oh, that's a really fascinating thought. You know, it's interesting because I was just reading about that and I hadn't even considered how variable the phenotype and presentation could be and how that might affect not only the testing, but also triaging, right?
Correct, yeah.
Interesting. Chris, what are your thoughts?
Maybe I can come at this from a having taken care of just a handful so mm-hmm. far of patients who have been rule outs and have all ruled out, I'm happy to say. Yeah. The actual physical limitations of what we can bring into rooms and take out of rooms was an interesting barrier to me because of the way I'm used to communicating with patients. So I'm used to communicating with patients. I try to sit down and make eye contact and I like to take notes on a piece of paper and utilize a computer for review of history, review of things that we already know. But when it comes to someone telling me their story, I prefer to use like a pen and paper. That wasn't really an option for me. So I had to focus more on the computer. I don't know how that kind of granular stuff is stuff you guys want to hear.
Yeah, it is.
Help me to stop talking if you, because
no, that's actually,
I feel a little ridiculous saying that.
I love that. No, that's actually a really interesting point. That
it's just a different workaround. The face shields are a nightmare. I'm used to working with masks and gowns and gloves constantly, no problem. The face shields fog up. And so in order to, I had a patient rapid respond, we had to send to the ICU. And in order to see the computer and to see the patient, what was happening, I had to lift my head all the way back and look out the bottom of it because it was completely fogged. And that was a type of face shield that is a separate piece that you wear that kind of, it comes on sort of like a headband over your forehead and drapes down. And it just happens to like catch all of your hot, moist air coming out from the mask and just fogs. So that was a, boy, hey man, if you guys can come up with something different, that would be great.
I have a question for you about that. Is this something that you could anticipate providers just not wearing a shield because of?
I have a feeling we're going to run out of shields. And it's most important for people doing procedures and would be a problem for someone doing procedures. And Rhea could speak to that much more effectively because she does a million of them. But it would be a problem to see an ultrasound screen and those things. But it's not the care that I'm delivering on an everyday basis, rounding on patients, that's a problem. It's doing a procedure like putting in a central line, intubating a patient that we really need the masks for, the face shields for. The everyday care, if that goes out the window to preserve PPE, that's probably okay. We hope that we don't have to do that, but for procedures, it's going to be absolutely imperative to protect workers.
Oh, that's so insightful and helpful. By the way, for those that don't have video at the moment, we're taking notes on all this stuff so that we can look at them internally in Fast Track. So it's not just for podcast purposes. We are also taking notes so that we can prioritize and potentially tackle some of these. So this is helpful.
And just on that note, because of the way we're cohorting patients in the hospital and we anticipate to continue cohorting, at some point we will change units entirely into a COVID unit. So the provider would dress and gown, then go into the unit and take care of several patients who would all be positive at that point and leaving this stuff on for hours potentially. And so like having stuff that works effectively is really important so that we can provide the care for a long period of time and not just 20 minutes in the room. And then
was the idea of making a unit so that everybody sort of has to wear PPE the whole time? Was that sort of in an effort to reduce PPE consumption?
We haven't done it yet. And we don't want to spread disease between negative and positive people. So while we're ruling them out, each person is in an individual room. When we get enough patients that are positive, if it warrants blocking off areas, we have prepared to do that. Blocking off entire areas of a floor or an entire floor or an entire hospital.
I was speaking with another physician friend of mine who's in Louisiana, and they've already started designating specific locations like urgent cares as respiratory only and other places as non-respiratory, for example. Rhea, I want to hear your thoughts as well.
So as far as what Chris was saying about having these units where the idea is physicians go in with a set of PPE and essentially don't take that PPE off for hours at a time. If you look at places that have had to do this, like in China and in Italy, looking at those doctors' faces at the end of the day, they actually do have cuts and abrasions on their face day in and day out wearing the same PPE. And so broken skin is skin that can get infected. So that PPE also has to be comfortable and for hours of wear at a time. So that's one thing, just sort of tacking onto what Chris was saying. As far as procedures go, I did email a picture of one solution that an institution has come up with for covering their ultrasound machines going into these COVID rooms. Now, some of our machines have actual physical buttons that you can press. Our newest ultrasound machines are all touchscreen. Obviously, a piece of plastic is not going to work for that. So if we do decide that we need to put plastic on all of our machines, we're going to have to figure out a way that we can do a touchscreen or operate a touchscreen through that. I agree with what Chris was saying about procedure masks have to be fogging to get any type of procedure done.
I hadn't thought about other equipment that has to be taken in and out of rooms like ultrasound. Are there other pieces of equipment or tools that you can think of? I mean, Chris mentioned notepads and that sort of stuff, but kind of open the floor.
I would say just a simple stethoscope. I mean, it's, you know, these are patients you're trying to rule out pneumonia, but there's a lot of concern amongst physicians for, and sorry, this is Rob, but there's a lot of concern amongst physicians for cardiac problems that can also follow many of these people. There's some reports that we've heard where, you know, people certainly present with this pneumonia and then severe respiratory problem, you know, with severe respiratory distress and respiratory disease, but then they're dying of cardiac problems as the virus somehow causes cardiac dysfunction. You know, so ideally you'd be able to listen to their lungs very well and understand, like, hey, is this the same pneumonia that I was hearing before? Or gosh, am I starting to hear rails, which are basically like fluid in the lungs? Am I starting to hear that as well? Because that might be our first tip off. And currently we have to use these disposable stethoscopes. If we don't use our own and have to disinfect them, and I call them like Tonka toy stethoscopes. I mean, they're terrible. They're the kind of thing that you're just like, I'll just bring it to my kid as a plaything, because as a physician, it's just really not nearly as useful. I mean, you know, we use these $100 stethoscopes, you know, $150 stethoscopes, whatever they cost. And to go from that to a plastic 25-cent disposable one, it's a big deal.
I just bought one, Rob. It was almost $300 for a cardiology force stethoscope. And, you know, one workaround, sorry, this is Chris, one workaround would be a sheath that's disposable, similar to what we use for the ultrasounds for our sterile procedures. I would much prefer to use my own stethoscope or something like it, where I could feel like I was protecting others and myself with a disposable sheath that would be part of sort of the PPE as you go in the room. Because like Rob said, I have, my hearing's not that great and to start with, and then you give me a plastic, you know, a terrible stethoscope. Also, speaking of which, the ER is already using their own stethoscopes and cleaning them because they are already running out of the appropriate contact stethoscopes.
Can I ask a question about how the cleansing is done?
There are wipes. Mm-hmm. There are specific wipes to use. We use everything. We have approved wipes that are standard for equipment that comes in and out of rooms. So a lot of equipment comes in and out of rooms. Glucometers come in and out of rooms. I got an EKG urgently on a patient that, you know, those things come in and out of rooms, and they're the technicians who use all of these items and nursing staff are trained to wipe them down with approved wipes. So making sure we have enough of those. I can't remember what the compound is, but there are, we have several different types of wipes in the hospital depending on the type of illness. For example, for C. difficile intestinal infections, you have to use a bleach wipe. You can't use the purple top. You have to use the bleach wipe. The purple top wipes work for everything but the C. diff. So there's a little bit of, you know, knowledge that has to go along with the appropriate cleaning. So that's important to disseminate, and then having the availability of the wipes for equipment that's going in and out.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, what happens when you run out of wipes?
Thankfully, that has not been an issue, and in other institutions that has not been an issue. So that's, I
think, well, that's the case. Good.
Yeah, that's good. Although it would be pretty bad. This is real. Sorry. It would be bad if we didn't start running out of the purple tops. If we wanted to get really high tech, what we're hoping that people will do is actually decrease the amount of times that folks have to go into the room, put PPE on, go into the room and get a set of vital signs. And so if we wanted to really save a couple of those visits per day, we would have a way of patients actually, if they're capable in the room, getting their own set of vitals and somehow reporting that out. And then obviously if, you know, they're in trouble or there's a set of vitals that's abnormal, that would have to be repeated. But if we could substitute one or two of those vital sign checks with like self vital signs.
That's a clever idea. We've been sort of trolling the internet for hacks and ideas. And we've seen a few things like that where I know that we passed one on to Rob about moving IV poles outside of rooms and just putting extensions on them so that
people don't have to do that in the MRIs.
Yeah.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. And it was like, oh man, that's a really cool idea. And this is sort of along the lines. We saw another one this morning where pharmacists were making recommendations that patients receive medications all at the same time during the day. And so it reduces the number of times like a provider has to go in and administer a medication. You know, if for obviously for patients that are non-emergent, I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, as long as they're not going to vomit if they do that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, if somebody has really walkie-talkie, I mean, theoretically, you could put a little medicine box in the room and just be like, hey, you know how to use this at home? Keep it up here.
Yeah.
That would be a totally different paradigm for, I don't even know for nursing, if legally they could just leave all the pills all there for the entire day.
Yeah, that's not as a patient part of the, or former member of the patient safety committee, I don't think that's allowed. And honestly, a lot of these patients are going to be too sick to do some of these things, but some of them won't be.
I'd like to shift, unless anybody else has anything to add to those comments that were made by Ruben, which thank you. Those were really helpful. Nabil, you've been writing furiously in the background on all these things that we haven't even thought of. So this is really helpful. Anything that you guys want to add?
I just have a question to pose. So for your typical COVID patient, what procedures does hospital medicine expect to perform? I think one or two of you mentioned that you're on a procedure service or that's your background.
Hey, this is Rhea. I think probably the most common procedures that would need to be done would be central lines. Point of care ultrasound is something that I think people are sick of me talking about, frankly, but using ultrasound diagnostically, it's not necessarily a procedure, but we'll need to bring equipment into the room. But as far as procedures are concerned, the ones that I see most are ultrasound-guided IVs or central lines.
Okay, I was going to be my question about why ultrasound on a COVID patient, if yeah, guiding IV placement.
But no, more than that. Rhea, go ahead.
If you've looked at any of the Italian, what's going on in Italy, it's actually part of their protocol. So they do lung ultrasound once or twice a day in all of their COVID patients. And the findings that you see on lung ultrasound actually portend kind of the signs and symptoms that they'll have within hours. And so it actually, their symptoms will lag what you see on ultrasound. And then Bob alluded to 7% or so will have a cardiomyopathy and will actually die from cardiomyopathy after, you know, their respiratory symptoms may be getting better. And so people will kind of breathe a sigh of relief. Respiratory symptoms are better, and then all of a sudden their ejection fraction goes down. And so if we can catch that sooner, we can do that with point of care ultrasound instead of sending them down to cardiology or having the cardiologists bring their big ultrasounds into the room, which are obviously a little bit harder to disinfect.
That's really fascinating. All right, anything else?
Yes, other things that, I mean, nurses do every day, which is place just peripheral IVs. Central lines are big IV lines, arterial lines are smaller lines that generally go into the wrist, echocardiograms. So those are big, as Rhea mentioned, those are big machines. And very high degree of user specificity. We already maxed at our capability to get those done efficiently in the hospital. So I expect that to be a problem. So providers who are trained on point of care ultrasound for at least screening purposes would be important. And then intubation and mechanical ventilation are something that we hopefully won't be called to do, but the ICU docs are doing, and we may be, you know, depending on how bad this gets, general internists might be having to do some intubation as well. ECMO is another one, extracorporeal membrane oxygenization. We have the capability only to do about 10 of those patients at a time at our institution. And that will be it already is a resource that's scarce. That is, other hospitals don't have it. Not everybody has it. Most of our community hospitals would not be able to do ECMO. And like I said, we only have the capability to do 10. So much less needing to be judicious about our ventilator use, which we're hoping that we won't have to be, but we definitely will have to be extremely judicious in ECMO use.
So for the kind of your severe to critical patients, which of the procedures you just listed, would they expect to receive all of those, or?
They will be intubated. Early intubation is actually recommended. Typically, if they're sick enough to be in the ICU and intubated, they're going to get a central line, maybe an arterial line. ECMO, I think, is going to be reserved for folks that are fairly young, chance of coming back after that procedure. But I think those are probably the more common ones that we're going to see.
Yeah, and this is Rob. One of the things that I think about also is just, I think a lot about how do you contain the infection within the hospital? How do you keep people well? I mean, we actually have a 3-deep sign up right now, not actually really a sign up, but a 3-deep assignment for sick call right now, because we're anticipating so many people being out. And when I think about that, you know, that's what we're doing as physicians. You know, there's other parts of the hospital, whether it's, you know, dietary or just the cleaning staff, you know. And I'm going to tell you, every time I've ever seen one of the people delivering food come into a room, their PPE is a disaster, or getting somebody just to come in and clean up the trash. Well, half the time I see them come into the room and they're like, well, I'm just going to pop in here real quick. And so they kind of skirt the PPE. They certainly are not taking, you know, 5 minutes to put it on correctly and make sure their whatever mask is on appropriately.
And Rob, I can comment on that too. What's already been happening when I was on Six Bed Tower is that the nurses are stopping folks and delivering food themselves. I do worry about the trash. I don't know what's happening with the trash. So the nursing staff is like, the food service is coming up to the floor, and then when someone needs to go into the room, because they have to log in and log out of the room. They don't log out, but we log in to a room. You know, basically you're taking the tray in with you, that kind of a thing.
That's fascinating. I hadn't even thought about those kinds of logistics.
The PPE is a huge problem, because even a beeping IV requires somebody to go gown up and go in the room just to tell the patient, oh, just stretch your arm out so it doesn't beep anymore, literally.
Yep.
Or we can look from the door. It's a lot. So it will be almost better when we get enough patients cohorted to not use so much and just be in it for a while. We also need to figure out creative ways to utilize providers and nurses and all of our staff that are like pregnant or might be pregnant. A lot of our hospital medicine colleagues are in their childbearing years, and we have a lot of people with young kids at home, and trying to maybe have them do chart reviews from home, helping with, there's people who can work literally from home and put orders in on patients to be like, hey, Chris, I saw that I screened your patients this morning. I saw that so-and-so's potassium and magnesium were low. I wrote for it. That kind of thing. Stuff that could be creative solutions to utilizing providers in ways we haven't considered.
Yeah, makes total sense. I mean, if you're trying to control infection and also like make use in a creative way of a short staff or all the people that may not be able to come in, I think that makes complete sense. I want to shift gears a little bit if you guys are cool with that. I kind of want to ask hypothetical questions of you. So one of the things that we were pondering inside of Fast Tracks are the things that would put us at ease if we knew people were working on it. And I thought it would be helpful to gauge your perspective on that question, which is, imagine that you could ask for any sort of thing to be developed or worked on at this very moment. What are those sorts of things? Like, what would put you at ease if people or engineers or hospital administration, whatever it might be, was, quote, working on to make COVID management easier? And it's a little bit of an abstract question, but I kind of thought it would be an interesting one to ponder. I wonder if, and it is sort of in the same lines of what we just talked about, and I thought it might be an interesting question to ask. So, Nick, I haven't heard from you in a while. I'll call you out and ask if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I apologize for that. I haven't been taking quite as a front seat caring of the COVID patients as some of the other folks in this meeting. So, but as far as things that I think would make us more comfortable in the care of these patients, the idea that I kind of have is one that kind of piggybacks off something that that Rhea actually brought up in a meeting that we had yesterday, and Rob was also touching on it with these patients who are dying from cardiovascular issues after improving. If there was a way that we could, you know, more closely monitor cardiovascular function, like in addition to telemetry, whether it was, more frequent echocardiograms or, just some way of, kind of knowing sort of what somebody's ejection fraction was in real time, I think that would be like incredibly helpful for, identifying the people that you really need to be focusing your efforts on and, kind of identifying the people at highest risk who are sick.
Thanks. Rhea?
That's a complicated question because what I actually do really want is to be able to bring ultrasounds to the bedside, but that's more of an issue of PHI. And if we're using our we have handheld ultrasound machines that connect to our iPhones, and how do we keep those infected and secure? Disinfected is less of a problem than HIPAA security. And so I'm sort of trying to fight those battles separately, and I realize that's a completely different call.
No, that's really helpful. That's exactly the kind of stuff we're interested in.
Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Any of this stuff is helpful. I mean, this is stuff I never even knew or thought of, right?
Yeah.
So this is great.
I mean, that's sort of my thing. So point of care ultrasound is kind of my thing. There's a real need for this. That's a little bit, the belief of this is a little bit lagging, I think, in the United States. It's interesting that they were kind of hit the hardest after China, because they're also the ones that are sort of the most facile with, or Europeans in general are just more facile in accepting of using ultrasound for purposes and to drive their therapies. And so they are sort of have more of a belief in it. That's a cultural shift that needs to happen. And all of those things are kind of what I'm battling right now. I think the most concrete things are how do we keep our machines disinfected going from room to room, and then kind of battling the culture shift of is it even needed? Is it helpful? Does it drive therapies? That's more of an educational and competency issue.
Absolutely. No, that's very helpful. Hey, Chris, I'm curious to hear from you.
The biggest gridlock is testing. right now, I think if we could, I remember, but when I worked for a biotech company before I went to med school, we worked on developing different types of tests. That was one of the areas of the company. And I wonder if we can't be, it's hard to not expose people to a virus, but like there's other biotech companies out there. You know, there's places in the triangle that know how to do PCR. I wish we had a way that we could use those resources and those people who know how to do this, and they do it every day as part of their research. I wish we could somehow utilize them to get this testing off the ground, because that's a biggest question mark for care, and it's slowing care down in the hospital. And it really needs to not slow the care down. Like, who needs to come in? Who should we be watching? That kind of thing. Other things that I think, knowing if I can pass along, you guys should know and feel confident that the whole hospital system and the state are trying to come up with, or have come up with, tiered solutions about where patients go, cohorting patients together, trying to limit, to be open and available for the other emergencies that happen every day. And I've seen a lot of teamwork, so I just want to put you at ease if I can for that. That's the biggest concern I have right now in terms of a red flag.
No, that's really helpful. I thought, I'm just trying to get a perspective, and I think I'm glad you mentioned sort of the putting folks at ease, because I mean, obviously this is getting recorded for a podcast, and I think there's a lot of panic mode that's happening, amongst the community outside of those that are working in the hospital. And it's helpful to hear that, I think, to say like, hey, there's plans in place and we are actively trying our hardest to make sure that we're managing this problem in a safe and effective manner. It's been about half an hour, so I want to be, you know, cognizant of folks' time, but I also wanted to give Rob sort of the last word on this question. Rob, what are your thoughts on sort of things that you wish or want people to be sort of working on that would help out?
I know I've said this kind of through probably the theme of what I discussed, but it's how do we decrease the contagiousness? And I know, you know, the virus is itself contagious, but like, how do we get to the point that maybe that's a change in how we do PPE, maybe that's something else, but how do we make it so that people don't fear this contagion as much? I did a admission for a rollout who also was negative, luckily, probably about a week and a half ago. And the thing that struck me was the absolute fear, even by several healthcare providers. And I know Chris is trying to invoke confidence, but I'll just say, you know, healthcare providers are human. And it was really hard to get people to help me kind of just go in the room and take care of this person to do things that needed to be done because there was just so much fear and of not doing their PPE properly, of whatever it might be. They were just fearful of contagion themselves. And for myself, my personality is more like, hey, you know, I'd like to be in it, but I'll be honest, I've had a family member say to me, hey, I'm scared about this and I really don't want you to go and sign up to be the first doc in the room. And that's hard. I mean, professionally, it's like, it's not what I wanted to do, but I also need to respect this family member. And, you know, and right now we're kind of working on this, at least within our group, we're working kind of on a volunteer who wants to volunteer to be the first one up, you know, but we also kind of know this is kind of like it was in World War II, you know, there's the volunteers, but eventually the draft will come. And that's, I think, what we're all looking at the moment. And, yeah. And like I said, if there was a way so that it just absolutely. In general, thanks, you know, guys. People could look at this and be like, I'm not as scared about catching this. That to me would go a long ways towards helping us get the care to people that need it. And like Chris was saying, I mean, there's a lot of people who are coming in the door. They don't even have this, but we still need to give them care. And if they're coughing or short of breath, people are going to kind of freak out. And we need to be able to take care of those other people as well who have other problems and not have that slow us down.
Yeah, absolutely. Rhea, you've got your hand raised.
So just piggybacking on Rob is saying, I think the fear of running out of PPE is high and it's justified. So this morning during a leadership conference, we threw out a number of, we only have X number of face
Thanks
shields
much.
And All it right. was low. If you look on Twitter and other hospitals in the United States, they're talking about piecing together masks. That's what keeps me up at night, honestly. Just that basic thing of having to like sew masks out of surgical gowns for us to use.
Yeah, well, it's funny you mentioned that. So actually, that's one of the two areas that Fast Tracks and biomedical engineering at the university are working on. So I can maybe offer a little bit of peace of mind. Yeah, we're actually, you know, it's funny. I spent a large portion of yesterday and yesterday evening working on designs for a mask, actually using basic materials, but that would still function equivalent to or close to equivalent to an N95. But so we're working on it, actually. So maybe that puts you at ease a little bit.
At the CDC this morning changed their guidelines so you can use bandanas. And I think when we get to that point, like it's really kind of hit.
Can I add one thing to your stakeholders
please
list
do, please
that
do.
I saw
yeah,
in that
do,
patient
please,
cycle?
Absolutely.
Can you put janitorial staff?
Yeah.
That's huge. If we can't clean, we can't work. So please.
This is helpful.
In,
yeah.
Like,
and
somewhere.
I should full disclosure, that list is completely based on what we could think of. We're not providers.
No, it's all good, man. It's all good. Like all the people who work. So like the folks who deliver food, the folks who clean the hospital, we can't do it without them. So they're integral, especially in this scenario. We have, you know, utilizing more like UV cleaning systems. That would be great if we had that. You could throw a device in the room. It cleans the room. By UV.
Yep.
That's awesome. Wish we had more of those.
This is all really helpful validation for stuff that we've been thinking about and working on. So this is wonderful feedback.
Oh, I was going to say that one thing about the UV, no people can be in the room with current UV technology we use. So that's the big trick. So if the patient's in there, you're going to fry them. They're going to have a sunburn to kill all sunburns. So
I just wanted to quickly touch on this. So as we anticipate kind of providers starting to be removed because of infection or for whatever concerns, like, I'm curious, where do you expect to see that weak link first? Like, is it in terms of providing patient care? Will it be getting basic vital signs? Will it be performing procedures? Like, where do you expect, you know, as you dial down the number of providers that can interact with, or that patient to provider ratio, where are you most concerned about kind of your ability to provide care?
I think it's hard to know. Nursing is highly exposed. You know, they're in the rooms constantly. And, you know, I think any individual nurse will spend far more time with one particular patient, even if they've got 5 or 6 patients. You know, they're going to spend individually a lot more time with that one individual patient than I might as a physician, because the reality is that, I mean, I still end up having to do a lot of paperwork and I'm putting in orders outside of the room. I don't know. I mean, we're, you know, at the same time, we're, you know, as physicians, we're kind of exposed in different ways that might put us at higher risk. So I worry about the emergency room because...
Oh, the ED and nursing.
Yeah, especially ED nursing and the triage nurse, you know, they might be gowned up because they're kind of expecting anything. But the average nurse in the emergency room, how deep are we there?
I think the ER is going to be the hardest hit right away. They're already at max capacity on any given day, and that's going to be the hardest.
And is that just because of patient volume, like increasing patient volume, or?
Yeah, and like Rob said, fear. I had a couple of people get like, you know, just literally they had good reasons. They had risk factors to be worried, but as we ramp up testing, this will get better. But in terms of exposures, the ER is going to be the weakest link.
That's helpful. Thank you.
You know, I think it's hard to say where the weakest link is going to be, just because, you know, we don't really know. But I'll tell you where my greatest fear with it lies. It's, and you know, if we are losing people who are, you know, skilled and being able to manage the ventilators. I'm hearing these stories from Italy of running out of ventilators, basically, is frankly terrifying. So, you know, I think a lot of us are even starting to kind of refresh our skills on managing vented patients. But
that is a really great point. The number of ventilators that we have, if we go the way that Italy goes, we're going to outpace that, and we're going to have to start to make some pretty hard decisions about who gets on a ventilator and who does not get on a ventilator. And so what I have seen, and I will tell you, Med Twitter is on fire right now. But what I've seen on Med Twitter is actually creating a way of joining 2 patients on a single ventilator.
I was thinking about that. That's really interesting.
Yes.
Wow. They'd have to be really closely sized.
That's part of the requirement, actually.
Yeah. If you guys are working on that too, I think you're ahead of the curve.
It's in the back of our mind. I saw that post that you're talking about. I think there was an example of it used in Seattle, But somebody who had trained with the person who studied that, and you can do up to 4 patients at once on a single vent. But yeah, you have to do things like match their volume and resistance and all this stuff.
And they're using 3D printers to create those pieces, if I recall correctly.
Oh, really? The one I saw, they were cutting connectors off of another component that was found in the respiratory cart. I don't remember what it was, but yeah.
Basically, people are MacGyvering whatever we need to MacGyver in order to stretch the ventilators out.
It is actually one of the 2 topics that Fast Tracks is working on at the moment, is the ventilator problem and whether or not there's other options.
I was going to say the other thing is it's been years since I've had to intubate a patient.
That's right. Go ahead, Rob.
So there are tools like fiber optics that are available today, but adult medicine hospitalists and a lot of big academic centers, you don't do the intubations. And that is a very high risk procedure. You absolutely need a face mask when you do that. I remember during H1N1 where we intubated somebody and there was so much fluid that came out of the endotracheal tube. I mean, it looked like somebody had a faucet. The room was just sprayed down with fluid. Everybody in the room got hit. It's gross. It is what it is. And so you put those tubes in. Right now, there are fiber optics, but I've never specifically been trained in using what's called the glidoscope. And do we have enough of those to meet the demand of what could be expected? Anesthesia at our hospital.
So anticipating maybe a need to brush up on those skills, how I mean, what's your trajectory there? Is there a plan? Is there a way to train on that so you'll become more competent? Is it just like interacting with more patients? Because this is something I've heard. I saw a meme the other day by a gynecologist friend that said, like, stay at home or else, unless you want to be intubated by a gynecologist, which was...
Yes.
But I'm just curious about training and kind of building that skill again.
Well, so there's two things. One, Rob has sent out to everyone reminders that there's a really good online course that the Society of Hospital Medicine has for management of fluid resuscitation in critically ill patients, as well as ventilator management. And then in addition, they've asked for we don't have just a COVID volunteer staff. We have, they asked for some of those providers who would be willing to work like on a team with an ICU doc. So basically sort of in tandem to help to get things done almost like we would be, the way I would think about it would be like a resident with an ICU doc sort of supervising or someone to be able to manage questions as far as training goes, looking at trying to train up a smaller group of providers who are willing to sort of be a backup for our ICU docs or for the less sick folks who don't need ECMO and who don't have severe ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome. We're working on it, but it's dependent on providers right now to brush up their skills. And then for that subset of providers who wants to volunteer for those things, at this point, there'll be additional training as far as what's required at this point. Nothing's technically required.
Awesome. Well, thank you all very much for joining us today. I really appreciate it. That was very insightful. And as I mentioned before, this will definitely guide our thoughts going forward. So I want to thank you, Nabil, for scheduling this. Thank you to Nick and Rhea and Rob and Chris for joining us today. I really appreciate all of your time and all of your insight. And good luck. Stay safe out there.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Bye-bye.
We hope you enjoyed learning a little bit about the anticipated needs in hospital medicine with respect to COVID-19. If you or someone you know feel they could help with any of the unmet needs discussed in today's episode, please send a message to guidewire@unc.edu. While you practice social distancing, check out our other episodes and subscribe to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite streaming service. Visit our website, guidewire.unc.edu. As always, I'm your host, Devin Hubbard. Stay safe. We will talk to you next time.
Learn more about our exciting activities, opportunities, and team by subscribing to the Guidewire podcast on your favorite listening service. If you have identified an unmet medical need or are interested in learning more about our process, visit us at guidewire.unc.edu. You have been listening to Guidewire, a direct line to medical device innovation.